Blog Talk Radio.
I was busy doing activities on a busy Saturday afternoon and had no idea that the country would be talking about this story for a complete week. We're talking about the Tucson tragedy and what happened, why it happened, and how can we make sense from the senseless. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas, and we're going to have a very special show dedicated to those who passed away and died innocently in Tucson, Arizona, those who struggled to live, and those who lived in spite of on this very special day. And then we'll turn our attention to the 98th anniversary of a very special organization that I am a part of, Delta Sigma Theta. This is Carol, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Good morning, everyone. Don't know where you happen to live, but if you live anywhere in the United States, there's probably snow on the ground unless you're in Florida. It's my understanding that of all of the 48, the 50 states, obviously we have 50 states, but at least 48 of the 50 states have snow on the ground. We had a bucket load dropped on us yesterday, as did happen in Connecticut. I think in Connecticut they had a record-breaking snowfall there. My daughter lives in West Hartford. And so we're all digging out, and hopefully we'll be able to move forward, go back to school, go back to our normal lives. It's been quite a winter so far, and it certainly has been quite a season of violence. I look back historically on the violence in the United States. This country has had episodes of violence since the very beginning. It was born as a result of a Revolutionary War. But for other reasons, violence seems to permeate in the United States, and in so many ways, there are political implications to the violence that takes place in our country. Again, back on Saturday, when I was busy doing other things and happened to be in touch with someone who said, "Did you hear about the Tucson shootings?" I had no idea what they were talking about, and then I checked online and found out 20 people had been shot by a lone Jeffrey Launer, who apparently is somewhat of a misfit in society, 22 years old, run-ins with the law, drug activity, kicked out of community college in Arizona, and then for whatever reason decided to turn all of his hatred and craziness out on 20 people, killing 6 of them and wounding 14, including Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who is a Democrat representing that district in the country. We pay tribute to the 6 who are now gone to glory, including Dorothy Morris, 76 years old, who in earlier articles was named Dorothy Burry. I'm just pulling this from one of the news feeds. Also, John Roll, who was 63 years old, the chief judge for the U.S. Court of Arizona, U.S. District Court of Arizona, tragic end to his long and respectable career. Phyllis Schreck, who was 79. Well, this is Carol again. I'm not sure what happened, and I'm going to actually ask my guest to call back in. Hopefully he will call in soon. Obviously we've had weather problems here and power outages, so clearly something definitely happened, and we're hoping that our guest will call back into the show. I was actually talking about the unfortunate realities of what happened with the Arizona shootings. And with that said, we're just so sad about what happened. I'm going to actually probably send an email to my guest so that he will call back in and we'll be able to have his interview on. But it's just such a tragedy of what took place, what happened with the unfortunate realities of the shooting that took place in Arizona. Again, I'm going to send an email to my guest. And then I will read the names again of those who passed away. I had quite a few things I wanted to talk with our guest with today, Andy Barr, who is a political reporter for Politico magazine. So I'm going to ask him to call back in. and we will hopefully get him back on the line very, very soon. But again, let me just read these names. For some reason, the line disconnected. But anyway, the six people who passed away: Gabriel Zimmerman, 30 years old. Gabe Zimmerman, he worked for Congresswoman Gifford's staff as a community outreach director for some time, and just was a great guy, was scheduled to be married. He was engaged to be married. He passed away with this crazy gunman. Also, Dorwin Stoddard, 76 years old, was shot in the head trying to protect his wife. Seemed like just a delightful man. Phyllis Schreck, who was 79 years old, again, killed by the shooter. Also, John Roll, 63 years old. He was the chief judge for the U.S. District Court for Arizona. A very respected person. I believe we have our guest here. And then also Dorothy Morris was killed. And then Christina Taylor Green, 9 years old, was unfortunately killed. And again, it's just a tragic situation. We want to talk to our political reporter from Politico.com, Andy Barr, who has dialed back in. Andy, we're so sorry that we lost you the first time. There must have been some technical glitches with Blog Talk, but we're glad to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for being on with us.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a sense of, again, my issues with this entire case looks at what are the political dotted lines, not direct lines, but political dotted lines that go between an individual like this who targets a U.S. congresswoman and the influence that he perhaps has had with some of the political conversations and things that have been said on particularly conservative talk radio and talk television as well. What are your thoughts about that, Andy Barr?
Well, you know, I think this is something that we're all looking at a lot right now, and we're trying to, you know, like rationalize what happened. But you know, like from the evidence that we've seen so far, this guy was not involved in the day-to-day discussion. He didn't follow talk radio. You know, a friend of his said that he didn't watch TV, he didn't like the news. And so, you know, like, well, I think this is a fair thing for us to look at. And, like, you can draw the trend line. In fact, we had a story doing it, showing that the instances of violence against members are significantly up if you include all the incidents like last summer in spring where a gas line was cut to one. You know, you draw that trend line, you know, I think it's fair to conclude that there's something toxic in the political environment. But in this particular instance, no one really knows what motivated this guy. And until then, it's kind of unfair to point fingers one way or another. But at the same time, like, it's all a time that we can kind of step back and see, you know, what kind of part and role, like, individuals have played in creating, you know, not the greatest environment.
You know, what's disturbing for me is as I look at what has happened over the last couple of years and the number of incidences like that have happened, they're issues driven. It's not like this young man went back to his community college and became very angry because he was thrown out of school. He was very disruptive, and you know, he didn't go back there and turn his anger on his classmates or certainly his faculty members, the math teacher that's been on television. I mean, he specifically, and this is the mystery of it all, he specifically targeted someone in a very political position. You know, and I'm looking at the case of the guy who, other incidents that have taken place over the last 2 years where political or issues-oriented individuals have been targeted and then killed or wounded by individuals who just have just gone crazy. That's the concern that I have.
Right.
And
yes, first is like there. You just have to account for. I mean, things as stalkers do exist, right? I mean, like famous people have these things. Politicians are included in this. A lot of politicians haven't had stalkers. And then, I mean, I think like the comparison a lot of people are making with this attack is the one by John Hinckley on Ronald Reagan. That was for no clear political motivation. I mean, you know, you're right that some members have been targeted for what seems like political reasons. When we were talking about the gas line that was cut, that came after a Tea Party activist posted what turned out to be the wrong address of a congressman. It actually went to his brother's house.
Right.
But, I mean, the environment right now is nothing like what we saw in the 60s and 70s, where we were seeing consistently public figures killed for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we hope that we don't get to that point, but I think, you know, like right now would be a good like kind of place for everyone to just like take a step back and like just see if they can calm down just a tad.
And certainly President Obama last night with his speech with the memorial service was really a memorial celebration. With the atmosphere that they were in, he certainly set the tone. I've actually, you know, pulled his speech and looked at it, and he paid tribute to every single person who passed away. You know, but he also made some very, very strong statements about, so yes, we must examine all the facts behind this tragedy. We cannot and will not be passive in the face of such violence. We should be willing to challenge old assumptions in order to lessen the prospects of violence in the future. So, you know, clearly that particular passage of his message was talking about the violence aspect of it. I'm not so sure that this strictly is a mental illness case. Obviously, this gentleman is mentally ill. There's no question about that. I think we all agree on that. But I guess my question is, and is this something that your organization is looking at as the articles are coming out, what goes beyond mental illness? You know, is there just a line between this kind of violence and mental illness, or what goes beyond the whole the targeting piece? And I mean, that leads us to Sarah Palin and her map. Is there a connection between people who do something like this and political activities, which can include conservative organizations, can include extreme organizations on both sides, and what literally pulls the trigger for people like this to do and target political figures or politicians? Any thoughts on that?
Right. I mean, first, there's like there's no question that there is an extremist element, and that it has proved, you know, very damaging to like kind of the political culture, the political climate, and has at even times proved violent and deadly to some people. You know, that said, like when I was saying that it's time for like people to step back, like that's not just like Ed Schultz and Rush Limbaugh, like that's us too. Like you know, those of us who are in the media, those of us who are reporters, like I think need to avoid like jumping to conclusions on this thing and really wait until the criminal complaint's filed, until we see what evidence there is. I mean, you remember going back over this weekend, if you look at like all those breaking news alerts that people get in their email and stuff like that, a lot of it was information that wasn't true and was proved later. I mean, there were reports that she was dead. There were reports that she was up and talking on her way into the hospital.
Yeah, I missed all that because I was doing other things, and I found out about this after the fact. So it was like very late Saturday night when I realized that something like this had happened. So I missed all the breaking news alerts that had come out. So I guess I'm asking – yes, go ahead. I'm sorry, Andy Burr.
Well, I was just saying, like, if we're going to ask that commentators try to look at things that are true versus things that are emotional in their reactions to things, I think we're just as culpable for that, for, like, trying to not assign blame or not assign reason to things that may not have reason.
Well, let me just sort of ask you now, as we look at some of these possible connections, and clearly I don't think anybody wants to inaccurately accuse someone of doing something this tragic that shouldn't be more accountable. And I'm looking specifically at Sarah Palin. I was concerned yesterday. I was on another radio program on Blog Talk, Dr. Rhonda Waters' show. She's actually listening in right now on my show. And, you know, I asked the question, where is she? How come she's so silent when, in fact, she's so bold and courageously on her website put a map up there with their clearly crosshairs? It's nothing about the surveillance stuff. It's clearly crosshairs. And the question that's come in with our chat room is, you know, what do you make of Sarah Palin's, not only her remarks, but also the comments that she made yesterday, the video that she played yesterday?
I mean, first, I think she missed a really big political opportunity. And you don't want to see politicians being opportunistic in circumstances like these. But, like, it means something to your political prospects if you can connect with people on a really human and emotional level after a tragedy like this. And, you know, in a time when so many people are talking about toning down the rhetoric and, you know, getting rid of the blame and all that other stuff, she was pitch perfect for about 75% of that message. You know, she was extolling, like, the virtues of a country that can recognize free speech while at the same time, you know, prosecuting those who do wrong. And she was expressing sorrow for the victims and saying that, you know, the sometimes the environment that we put out there is venomous. But then she, like, kind of did this turn and had this, like, turn into victimization and how, you know, people were attacking her. And she used this strange term, blood libel, which it seems pretty clear her folks didn't really understand what it meant.
Right.
I mean, she really just kind of blew it. And all of a sudden this thing went from this moment where people had – the conversation had started to turn. And all of a sudden people were like, well, it's really not fair to blame her. It's really not fair to blame – you know, those on the right, if we don't have any proof of that, to all of a sudden it's like she had turned this into her and it had turned, like, very negatively against her. You know, all of a sudden we were talking about, you know, her acting as a victim in this terrible time. And it was just, you know, it really was a disaster politically for her.
Well, I said this yesterday, and I said, you know, had she not come forward quickly with the right kind of response, she was going to be pretty much null and void for 2012. And now that she's given that particular message and mixed in the blood libel piece and became very defensive when she should have been, I think, embracing the country in a much more conciliatory way where she can really show her leadership skills and how she can bring the country together, she didn't do that. So I just think that continue down this path, pretty soon she's going to be a footnote in history. She'll definitely have the Tea Party base. She'll definitely have the conservative base. But to me, she took an opportunity where she could have soared as a leader and quite frankly, fessed up to the inappropriateness of putting that kind of map on her website, which she didn't do. And she took an opportunity and didn't use it the correct way. Any other thoughts before we let you go, Andy Barr, about where we're headed with this? You know, are we going to repeat this again and again before we finally figure out how we can resolve these kind of horrific actions?
I mean, you know, you'd like to think that there's a takeaway, that there's a message, that there's, like, a lesson to be learned here. And I don't know if there is. I mean, people are talking about increased security for members, but the big downside with that is it would get rid of events like what Giffords was doing. I mean, you wouldn't be able to just, like, hang out in front of a grocery store and meet with, you know, people in your community. And if you think about it, like, what do these guys are perceived as so out of touch, and what's the one way that they stay in touch is going home on the weekends and doing events like this. And so I don't really see these guys, Tony, you know, all of a sudden having a big rope line and everyone getting screened and all this other stuff, because that kind of – that changes the whole atmosphere. But think, you know, the one takeaway is just, you know, hope that this isn't an indication of anything more to come, and, you know, just really, I mean, pray if nothing else, that this is the only incident like of its kind.
Well, I want to be as optimistic as you are. I wish we were all headed in the direction where we could resolve these kind of issues and certainly give people the help that they need and to provide the kind of love and attention to people when they really need it. I'm not so sure. I'm hopeful when I hear speeches from our president. I'm hopeful when I see the country rallying behind a city like Tucson the way they have. But I don't know. I think we have a long way to go. I'm hoping we'll get there, but not quite sure. But Andy Barr, thank you so much for being a guest on my program today. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Now, we're going to continue our discussion with this. I know we have a lot of people in the chat room and certainly want your feedback and your comments on this. This is really troubling. Glad that Andy Barr could join us for a little bit on political.com. I'm sorry for those of you who joined us at the very beginning. We had a bit of a glitch, but we resolved that. I'm really concerned about the United States still in a leadership role in our world being able to recognize its own problems and somehow resolve them in a way where we can move forward. That's the concern that I have. I'm really concerned. I'm concerned. We have listeners now in our chat room. My dear friend from Liverpool has joined us, Liverpool, England. Gareth Dallas is in the chat room. Dr. Rhonda Waters is in the chat room. Maybe you all can help me to figure out how we can move forward. Every time you hear of a case like this, particularly when it's I just think the political symbolism of it is disturbing. And then it's like unraveling or unpeeling the onion when you find out about this young man's life, when you get a sense of who he is. You get concerned about particularly young men who are loners, who have demons inside of them. When I look at that young man's picture, Jared Launer, and his picture is frightening. It's just it's frightening. I don't even like to look at it. I would not put it on my webpage. And when I was getting prepared for the show, it looks demonic. So, I mean, I'm thinking about, yes, the mental illness capacity, the capacity for people like this to explode, not just on themselves and their family, but explode at targets that then will catch our attention and we talk about it, and then something else happens, floods happen, Haitian anniversary of the earthquake we should be paying attention to. So many other issues catch us, and then we forget to really come back and loop back with this. So, I mean, my concern is, how can we as a people, particularly as an American people, as a worldwide audience, focus on issues long enough so that we can get to the root cause of these people, these kind of individuals who explode into violence? And how can the United States operate in a way where violence is not so prevalent as it is today? I know that things are different than they were in the 1960s. They're certainly very different than they were in the 1860s or the 70s, or certainly back in the time of this country's founding. But it is just, how can we handle issues and get to the root cause, particularly of violence? Dr. Rhonda Waters is saying this is a hard issue with many layers. It certainly is a hard issue with many, many layers. I look at our gun laws, and I look at the strength of the National Rifle Association, the NRA, and how they have literally blocked a lot of gun prevention laws and laws that can control the kind of guns that we have in our society. To their members' benefit, that's okay, but it certainly is not is not helping the country at all. I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, my family have been gun owners for years. My brother's a hunter. He's had guns for years. So, but he doesn't run around with a revolver or a gun that has a clip on it, a magazine clip on it, that will shoot out 31 bullets. That's just unbelievable. So we have laws on the books that hurt the people, that help the lobbying groups, that put us in harm's way. And I also think about the fact that you look at people who were at the grocery store. When I first heard about this on Saturday, I was out and I was reading information online, and I saw the grocery store where they were, and I said, wait a minute. First of all, what is the congresswoman doing at the grocery store, along with a federal judge who gets killed and other people? So I finally pieced the story together and realized that she was there for a particular activity. And it boggled the mind as to how something like this could happen. And, again, I'm going to call on my friends from the chat room to help me out with this. Rich Hamilton is here. He lives in the Phoenix area. Give me a sense of what's going on, what people are thinking about, what they're talking about in Arizona, and most importantly, how can we get to some kind of resolution so that this issue either can't happen again, or it happens so infrequently that we have to look up in history books to see when it can actually happen. It really disturbs me, and my daughter has a doctorate in clinical psychology. She works with those who have mental issues every day. But this targeting is not part of their equation, from what I can tell with the work and the clients that she works with. that's the targeting of specific issues, people, politicians, government officials, this whole anti-government movement that people are just hanging on to and want to act out with, along with, again, the conservative rancoring and loud noises that are coming from the right, coming from the Tea Party. That's what concerns me the most. That's what really concerns me as I look at the implications that you have, whether somebody watches a lot of television, whether they don't watch a lot of television, but how that particular element becomes attractive. It's almost like a magnet to individuals like this who then become very violent and their outbursts then turn to murder. Here, a 9-year-old young girl, Christina Taylor Green, born on September 11th. The irony of that, I'm just shaking my head at. She seemed like she was absolutely full of life. She seemed like she was the kind of individual who, was the kind of child where every parent would want to have someone like a child like that. And yet she's gone now. She's gone, died violently. I look at the couples who find each other in the late seasons of their life. The gentleman who rolled over on his wife and literally saved her so that she would not be killed. And just the stories are heartbreaking. We are encouraged because we know there's always a new day. We're encouraged because we know that we can always have the opportunity to talk to each other. And I'm just hoping that through all of this, we can get to the point of first realizing what the issues are with our country that we face, the issues that divide us, that deal with race and culture and politics and religion and political affiliation, and how we can somehow recognize our differences but use that as a new tool to learn more about each other so that we can begin the dialogue that we have been needing to have for so long. That's the ultimate thing. How can we begin that particular dialogue that will lead us into a new level of conversation and dialogue in this 21st century instead of resolving our issues using tools and techniques and violent methods that just solve no issues at all. That just is what I struggle with. And certainly as a diversity professional and someone who has worked in this field for quite a long time, it is amazing to me in terms of how we can't get on the same page, can't recognize that you can agree to disagree. It's okay to agree to disagree, but you need to do it in a way that shows respect and dignity to the other person. That's all that we're saying. I'm really hoping that now that we have the 112th Congress in session, we talked about that last week and what that means, what the implications are, but I'm really hoping that they will take a pause long enough under John Boehner, who I'm so sorry didn't make it to Tucson yesterday. But I'm hoping that under his leadership in the House of Representatives and then in the Senate with Harry Reid, that a new kind of discussion can take place, a discussion that will take place that will help them to set the pace in our country so that we can mirror what they do, that we can mimic what they do so that they can be the leaders that we need for them to be. Dr. Rhonda Waters has said, how long will it be until politicians go back to normal rhetoric? Don't know. That's the big question. That's the question that I'd like to have answered. I just want to read what President Obama said toward the conclusion of his speech, brilliantly delivered speech, a speech of healing, a speech delivered by a gentleman who is a father, is a parent. He looked at this from not just his leadership perspective, but he looked at what takes place and what had taken place last Saturday from the perspective of a father. And he said some just wonderful things. He said in toward the end of the speech, I believe we can be better. Those who died, and he really paid tribute quite heavily to those who had passed away, those who saved lives here, they helped me believe. We may not be able to stop all the evil in the world, but I know that how we treat one another is entirely up to us. I believe that for all the imperfections, we are full of decency and goodness, and that the forces that divide us are not as strong as that unite us. And that is the key. It's a matter of recognizing that we have brilliant individuals in this country. We have people who are full of promise and opportunity. When I look at the story that we ran last week, that we talked about last week with Ted Williams, and how overnight this gentleman has been given a new opportunity to shine and to reset his button in life and to sort of go through the chapters of redemption so that he can become a better person. I mean, that made me feel really good. I know earlier this week he had problems with his daughter. That hit the news. He ended up in the police station. He was not arrested. Hopefully he and his family will somehow come to terms with what has happened in his life. But just his whole story was just extremely exciting. So I look at that as, to me, the possibilities of the American people, the possibilities that I like to see with American people, where you can take individuals like Ted Williams, you can take people who have had bad things to happen to them, and they can then rebuild and reset their own buttons in life and move forward. Where you can have our political leaders who, no matter who they happen to be, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, whatever, that they can respectfully work with each other to hammer out the important laws that we have in life, that they can hammer out the important necessities that we need to really be about in our country, dealing with job creation, dealing with trying to rebolster and rebuild the economy to the fact that we can get way below the 9% unemployment rate that we have across the country. Those are the kind of things that we want to deal with. I'm just amazed at what can happen in this country. Gareth is saying he was in the U.S. for 2 weeks in December and January, and he was absolutely shocked at the level of hatred and rhetoric between politicians targeted at each other. Now, Gareth is a lifelong or almost a lifelong person who's lived outside of the United States. He's born in Jamaica. He lives in Liverpool. He's a respected diversity professional over there, and I can imagine it probably was quite a culture shock. And then our Tea Party friends are here in the chat room and asking about defining hatred, asking Garth to define hatred. I'm sure that conversation will continue throughout the life of our show. But again, I'm wondering why we can't figure this thing out. We know about technology. We are a great country. We are a country of wealth and resources and opportunities and great people. We are a country who has been on the scene of the world for 300 plus years, and yet we have these issues that we can't get through and get over. We struggle with them. We really struggle with them. I'm not quite sure what's going on in the chat room. My Tea Party friend is asking to define hate. And then he also talked about differing opinion does not equate to hate. And then he has said, was it a hate speech when Abraham Lincoln rebuked Stephen Douglas in the 1860s? That's the great debate that went on, the Lincoln-Douglas debate. That took place when Abraham Lincoln was running for president. So I'll see what happens in the chat room with that conversation. But again, I'm just looking at how words are killing people, how attitudes are killing people, and how if we're not careful in this country, we are going to lose our edge rapidly. We're going to lose our competitive edge because of the internal issues that we are just facing. I'm hoping, getting back again to our 112th Congress, that under the leadership of John Boehner, under the leadership of Senator Harry Reid, that they will begin to look at their differences and resolve issues in a manner that still has the respect factor at the front door, that they have a lot of bills to take care of, a lot of things to look at, but they need to somehow, in a respectful manner, attack each other verbally, but using the decorum that we have become accustomed to as human beings. Garth Dallas, I love chat rooms, he is saying, in a sense, I went well beyond political ideology, rather focusing on personal attacks. Please bear in mind, though, that I am seeing this through British eyes. And he said, and I should add, that it comes from both sides. So again, as someone not from the United States, Garth was in the country, he's seen things from a British perspective, and he sees a lot of hate. He sees a lot of rancor that's going on, and that is the concern that a lot of us have here in the United States. I want to read to you, again, a little bit more of what the president said last night in setting the tone when he was talking about Christina Taylor Greene, the little 9-year-old who was killed. And he said, that's what I believe in part because that's what a child like Christina Taylor Greene believed. Imagine here's a young girl who was just becoming aware of our democracy, just beginning to understand the obligations of citizenship, just starting to glimpse the fact that someday she too might play a part in sharing her nation's future. She had been elected to her student council. She saw public service and something exciting, something hopeful. She was off to meet her congresswoman, someone she was sure was good and important and might be a role model. She saw all this through the eyes of a child, undimmed by the cynicism or vitriol that we adults all too often just take for granted. I wanted to live up to her expectations. I want our democracy to be as good as she imagined it. All of us, we should do everything. We should make sure this country lives up to our children's expectations. And then our president goes on and says, Christina was given to us on September 11th, 2011, one of 50 babies born that day to be pictured in a book called Faces of Hope. On each side of her photo in that book were simple wishes for a child's life. And he goes on and talks about that. And then his closing comments, if there were rain puddles in heaven, Christina is jumping in them today. And here on earth, we place our hands over our hearts and commit ourselves to as Americans to forging a country that is forever worthy of her gentle, happy spirit. We're just hoping that somehow, in some kind of way, we can sort of live up to the expectations of a Christina Greene, that we can do it in a way of spirit and love and dedication and do it in a way that will help us as people. This is certainly a subject we're going to have to struggle through on this show. It has everything to do with diversity, empowerment, multicultural issues, and all the things that are very important in my life. And I'm hoping that somehow through the dialogues that we have in our chat room, and I thank everyone in the chat room for the conversations that are taking place, so that we can have this kind of bipartisan dialogue, international dialogue that we're now having that will help us to become better people, better Americans, better citizens of the world, so that the discussions and the dialogues will improve us and not destroy us. We're going to take a little break and then come back and talk about the wonders of Delta Sigma Theta sorority. Stand by, and we'll play a little clip from this new wonderful publication that I'm very excited about. We've extended our offers through the end of January, and we are hoping that you will just enjoy Connections Magazine. It's just an exciting, exciting magazine, and we want you to be a part of it. So stand by. Let's hear about Connections.
Connections Magazine is the magazine for you. We're looking for advertisers like you to be a part of our very first premier issue. Corporations, educational institutions, government agencies, nonprofit organizations, small businesses, entrepreneurs, community advocates, individuals, faith-based organizations, sororities and fraternities, associations, families, and those placing a memorial tribute. Connections is a news and professional development publication targeted at a multicultural audience of professionals, advocates, and emerging leaders who are making a positive impact on a globally diverse world. Our first issue of this specialty magazine will debut in the spring of 2011. The initial print run will be 10,000 to 15,000 copies distributed across Massachusetts, New England, and across the United States. This issue will have a special emphasis on global diversity and inclusion, its people, businesses, institutions, and organizations that impact the marketplace in our globally connected world. Our special holiday pricing provides you with an opportunity to select your advertising space in a cost-effective manner before the prices go up at the end of the month. When you advertise by December 21st, you save lots of dollars on your ad. Plus, you'll receive the free memberships in the Multicultural Symposium Series when you advertise in Connections. Pricing just right for your organization, large or small. And individuals can also advertise. To receive a media kit with pricing, please email me at tellcarole@mac.com. That's tellcarole@mac.com. And put Connections Media Kit in the subject line. Please indicate if you're a small business, nonprofit, or an individual. Or you can call me at 508-947-5755 if you have any questions or comments. I'm Carol Copeland Thomas, and I'm excited about Connections Magazine and want you to be a part of our big debut. Show your commitment to multiculturalism, global diversity, and inclusion. Advertise in Connections today.
Well, we're going to turn our attention now and talk about an organization that who would have ever thought it would have lasted this long. It lasted again because of the rancoring and the problems and the segregation that took place in the early 1900s, and now, 98 years later, it is alive and well and thriving. We're talking about the 200,000-plus women who were part of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, born at Howard University, and now all over the United States and different parts of the world. And we've brought in Boston Alumni Chapter President Tanisha Sullivan to talk to us more about Delta Sigma Theta. Tanisha, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you this afternoon, Carol?
I'm doing well. If you'll bear with me, I'm going to play for our listeners just a little piece that was on our website that is a special message from our president, Cynthia Butler McIntyre. So bear with me. I'm going to pull this up, and then we'll begin our discussion. It's just a little piece that is just a happy birthday about why this is such a great day for the women of Delta Sigma Theta. Here we go.
To my sorors of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, throughout the country, across the ocean, around the globe, and in every corner of the earth, happy Founders Day. On January 13, 1913, our 22 founders set out to create an organization on the campus of Howard University with the primary goal of providing support to the underserved, a path they cut and pave the way. 98 years later, that vision has been realized and has evolved into an organization of more than 250,000 women in nearly 1,000 chapters in the United States and abroad, working tirelessly to improve and empower their communities. Rendering service to others is what called our founders from where they were to where we are today. Service is what we do. Service is who we are. They saw a store and followed it. As Delta women, we strive each and every day to carry out our commitment to economic development, educational development, international awareness and involvement, physical and mental health, and political awareness and involvement. Sorors, thank you for all that you do to uphold the name of Delta Sigma Theta. Continue to follow in the footsteps of our beloved founders, and always remember that we are Delta Sigma Theta, a sisterhood called to serve, transforming lives, impacting communities. Let us not lose the way to strive and to attain for Delta. Happy Founders Day, Sorors.
Well, that's a special message from the national president of Delta Sigma Theta, Cynthia Butler McIntyre. And on the line, we have the Boston alumni chapter president of Delta Sigma Theta, attorney Tanisha Sullivan. Again, welcome again. Why is this day so exciting for all of us?
Well, I think when we take a moment to pause and reflect on 98 years of public service and have an understanding of the time frame that we're talking about, during which Delta Sigma Theta was founded, 1913, the early 1900s, just, you know, not even a generation out of slavery in this country, and to think that this organization was founded by 22 college women on the campus of Howard University who were black women at that point in time. It's profound. Whether we're talking about the racial environment in this country in the early 1900s or even the issues that women were facing in this country, yeah, these women were able to take really an active stand and say, not only are we here and not only are we going to pursue our dreams, but we want to do something in our community to make sure that we are lifting as we climb.
Right. And the thing is, I'm so glad that you sort of talked about that era. I mean, that was such a volatile time period. We think our days now are really tough. I mean, back then, the lynching rate was just off the chart. We didn't have the health care that we have today. We didn't have the level of insurance protection that people have today. Very different era, very scary era, because if you got sick or if you didn't have any education or if you were not a person from mainstream America, the opportunities for you to succeed were, were kind of slim. Yet these women just sort of stood through it all and transcended it all and moved ahead in a very interesting time period. Talk to us about just about the women of that era and the suffragette movement that they were a part of, Soror Tanisha.
So at that point in time, from just looking at the role of women in society, we were, certainly considered an integral part of society, but were primarily expected to be at home, tending to children, tending to the household, and really men were seen as the ones who were actively engaged in society, whether it was addressing policy issues of the day or being actively engaged in the political schemes of the day. And with that, women, we didn't have the right to vote. So in 1913, actually the first public kind of action that the women of Delta Sigma Theta participated in was the Women's Suffrage March and in Washington, D.C. And what's really interesting about that is that these women, the 22 women from Howard University, were marching in a march for the right of women to vote,
right,
knowing full well that they, as black women, would not have the right to vote. So from that, we have established a legacy really of, as Ms. Butler McIntyre mentioned, providing support to the underserved. We have consistently taken a position where we're going to stand up against injustice wherever we may find it, regardless of how it may affect us personally. We're going to do the right thing because it's the right thing, not because we have necessarily a self-interest in it.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, the whole thing, we started off as a public service sorority. And, again, we're having a very interesting conversation in our chat room. And again, shout out to all the Zetas, all the AKAs, the Deltas, because all of them have done a lot in this country in terms of public service. You know, I'm a Delta. My mother was a Delta. My daughter's a Delta. My sister-in-law's a Delta. I have cousins who are AKAs, and I definitely have friends who are Zetas. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we have this camaraderie that's here. But when you look at sororities, particularly sororities like Delta, you're looking at women who just sort of beat the odds. They are out there working. They're feeding the homeless. They're doing. They're providing scholarships for our young people, providing the kind of imagery that our young people need to have, and doing it in spite of all of the obstacles that they face.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that we focus on is really remembering, particularly on this day, that we are. We take a moment to pause and reflect upon the 22 women at Howard University, but we also recognize that we are part of an ongoing movement, and it really is a global movement. As you said, whether we are addressing issues relative to healthcare reform or and making sure that everyone has access to equal and quality health care in this country, or it's education reform, understanding that education truly is the basis for success in this country and around the globe. Education can lift anyone out of an underserved or poverty. Around the globe, or it's political access and making sure that those whose voices are often silenced have an opportunity to be heard. And so we are continuing the legacy of public service that was started by the 22 in 1913, understanding that there are still issues that need to be addressed.
Oh, many of them. We just host
exactly
half of the program talking about them. And in our chat room, we have a Tea Party member who's in our chat room, and he's asked
great.
A question. He's African-American, and he's been on the show before. But his question is a good question. He says, is there the same competitive environment with sororities that exist with fraternities?
That is a really good question. You know, I would say that within Greek organizations, and specifically Black Greek-lettered organizations, I have found that there is a sense of common purpose in public service, a commitment to community. And so I have not found that there is a competitive nature there. In fact, here in the Boston area, we have actively sought to collaborate with not only other sororities, but also with fraternities. Because we do have a common purpose. I would also encourage your readers, if they haven't had an opportunity to do so, the December 2010 issue of Essence magazine featured a conversation around sisterhood and collaboration among the historically Black sororities. And that
Great.
Was just a wonderful expose on our organizations and how we do work together and have sisterhood and public service as a common bond.
You know, we've even had a summit or a conference that was put on between the local chapter of Delta and the local chapter of AKA a couple of years ago, talking about financial fitness and entrepreneurial activities. So there is a spirit and a harmony that transcends whatever group you happen to belong to. And then obviously we've had social gatherings and social events where we've done the same thing. Can
Absolutely.
You very quickly talk to us about the upcoming event that's taking place in Washington, D.C., the first weekend, first couple of days of February, our legislative conference called Delta Days at the Nation's Capital.
Absolutely. Delta Sigma Theta has, over the past couple of decades, convened an annual legislative conference in Washington, D.C., during which members from all over the world convened to discuss issues relative to economic development, educational development, political access and political awareness. And we bring in speakers from all around the country to talk about those issues and to discuss how we can take an active role not only on the national level but also on the local level to address those issues. We also have a day set aside where all of us, the women in red, convene on Capitol Hill to meet with our respective legislators to kind of drill down on issues as they affect us here in the local, in our local communities. And we have, Boston alumni, we have participated, you know, of course, Carol is not going to say this on her own behalf, but she's certainly been one of our members who's made it a point to be in D.C. and to speak openly and honestly with our legislators to make sure that they know what our concerns are and that we are watching and that we do have expectations of them, which is so important because oftentimes we think of, we can think of our legislators as people who are kind of off doing something that, you know, who we don't have an opportunity to interact with. But it is quite the contrary. They are representatives, our congressmen and women are sent to represent us, and so they are accountable to us. And in many respects, I believe they need to meet with us when we request those meetings.
And you are so right, because last March, heavy flood, terrible weather, we're here in Boston meeting with Scott Brown. There were eight or ten of us around this table in his office asking him very poignant questions. And you're right, we wanted to know, how are you going to represent us? Not just members and people, constituents who supported you outside of Massachusetts, but how are you going to support those of us who are in Massachusetts? And so we have been active from the very beginning, and we will continue to be active too. Tanisha Sullivan, I just thank you so much for being a guest on my program. Happy birthday to all of the Deltas over the United States. We are gearing up for a big 100th anniversary that's going to take place in 2 years. I thank everybody in the chat room today. We've had an engaging dialogue in the chat room, and clearly this kind of conversation needs to go on again and again and again. So I thank each and every one of you. The question very quickly, what did Scott say? Scott realized that he was a Massachusetts Republican, and he ultimately had to represent the people of. And I actually asked the question, so I remember vividly what he said. So clearly, we're going to have to bring Tanisha back on the air, probably after Delta Days at the nation's capital. Will you agree to come back on and talk to us more about what happens once we go down to D.C.?
Oh, absolutely. Would love
Super.
To.
Thank you so much for being a guest on my program. I hope everyone has a peaceful weekend. No terrible weather issues, nothing violent that takes place. Come back again next week so we can talk. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas. Have a great weekend, and we will see you next week.